a 200-foot-long spacecraft in orbit that they can't bring back. So they send it on a trajectory that, no matter what happens, eventually it's going to deorbit. The plan was to deorbit, in this case, over the Indian Ocean. And in the process of doing this, they wanted to do a couple of tests with Starship. They want to make sure the cargo doors open and close. They said on the launch that apparently it was working, but I heard afterwards that it didn't work properly. So that needs to be worked on. The cargo doors would eventually put satellites into space, so they needed to test that. They also wanted to test refilling fuel from one tank to another tank. Again, they said, oh, that was in progress, and now I just heard a later report that maybe that didn't work. The idea is to be able to successfully transfer product fuel from one location to another. They're going to need to do that on a large scale in the future. They need to actually refuel starships in orbit. That was a test, and I don't think they succeeded on that, but we'll have to wait until eventually we get a report on that. This is WS2N. Relight of the Raptor engines. They wanted to do that in space as well. Apparently that didn't take place. And the main idea of this whole thing was to see if the tile protection system worked as it re-entered the atmosphere. The same idea as what Shuttle had. Shuttle had, I think, 40,000 tiles attached to the shuttle. And this thing has around, I think, around 20,000 tiles attached to it to see if it would re-enter the atmosphere. And it did start to do that. They showed the plasma that's coming off the vehicle as it came through the atmosphere, which you don't normally get to see. You know, when spacecraft come down through the atmosphere, it creates an ionized trail, and you can't transmit through that. So, you don't have any reception, you don't have TV, you don't have nothing on all these spacecraft that do that. Starship has, as you probably know, they have the Starlink satellites, thousands of them, I think almost 6,000 satellites in space. So at some point, when this thing's coming through the atmosphere, there was some satellites that were located slightly above the reentry point. So sure enough, the transmission of the television pictures of going through the atmosphere was actually working. It worked for a while, and it looks like it started to roll. It probably lost control. It looked like it was wobbling back and forth. From the pictures, you can see the Earth down below, and that didn't look right. And sure enough, apparently it burnt up. And they reported that they lost the Starship. So out of all the things that they tried to, I would say most of them actually failed. But they're happy that this thing got into space, and they're going to try again with Starship 4. Who knows when that's going to be. Unfortunately, it's bad for NASA because they need this company to succeed. They have a multi-billion dollar contract with Starship Starship is going to be the one that they're going to land people on the moon. One of these starships in orbit around the moon, and sitting there waiting for an Orion spacecraft with a crew of four to appear, also in orbit around the moon. Then the idea is to transfer from one vehicle to the other, have Starship go down, land on the moon with two of those people. And then the astronauts will eventually lift off on Starship and redock to Orion again. I think they're a long way off. I hope I'm wrong, but they need to have like one success right after the other to try to make the required time frame. They're looking at 2026 for this to happen. So, yep, quite a ways to go, I think. Any comments? WS1.
Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Charlie, I'm Charlie. Paul, I've got a question.
Good evening, Charlie. Yeah, very good. By the way, happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. Back to you, Charlie.
30 seconds and counting. What happened?
I doubled with you for a second there, Charlie, so I'm sorry. Say again.
There was a hold on the countdown at minus 40. What happened?
Yeah, well, then that was supposed to be a weather-related problem. So I don't know if that was an upper-level problem. That usually, you know, that caused a problem. But I just heard weather. You know, sure, it was cloudy. It was foggy. If you were at Boca Chica, Texas, and watched that thing take off, you didn't see much because right away it went through the clouds and it was very foggy, they said. But at home, we got to see it. I think it was weather-related, Charlie.
Got another question. What's the difference between the Raptor engines and the Falcon 9?
Yeah, the Raptor engines have been developed for Starship, and the Falcon 9 uses Merlin engines. And the Merlin engines, you know, that's the first ones that he developed, and then they had different versions of the Merlin engines. Yeah, the Merlin A, Merlin C, and I think what they use now is the Merlin D. So they just improvements of their engine. Those engines produce around, I think, 225,000, and I think they pushed it to 250,000 pounds per thrust per engine. So you put the 9 engines together on the booster of Falcon 9, and you get 1.7 million pounds of thrust. You have the Falcon Heavies going up. Of course, that's like 3 boosters bolted together. So then you have 27 engines instead of 9. But, each one produces around 200, I think it's 240,000 pounds of thrust. The Raptor engines, just double that. That's the way I think of it. He's shooting for 500,000 pounds of thrust, but I think it's just short of that. Probably 430,000 pounds of thrust. He's got a new Raptor engine that they're developing. They're trying to up that number a little bit. So, and the big difference, of course, is the fuel. Merlin engines run on refined kerosene and liquid oxygen. That's the fuel that they use. Where the Raptor engines are using liquid methane and liquid oxygen, of course. Back to you, Charlie.
If it's a liquid oxygen for the Starship, he has 10 billion pounds of fuel?
Yeah, it's roughly 10 times the amount that the Falcon has. Yeah. And so I have to deal with that. You know, it's 365 feet high, I think the whole thing is. So, yeah, I can imagine 98% of the whole vehicle is nothing but fuel, you know, liquid methane, liquid oxygen. It's like, you know, like a skyscraper taking off from Earth. Back to you, Charlie.
Okay, that answers a number of my questions, then. I'll be listening.
Very good questions. Thanks for that, Charlie. And, I'm just hoping they can get the Starship 4 out to the launch pad. You know, we do have a plan B. NASA has a plan B. A Starship doesn't really make it. They're working with Jeff Bezos Jeff Bezos has the company Blue Origin. And one of the vehicles they're developing is called Blue Moon. And that's a large vehicle. I mean, that's like probably 35 feet tall or more. That thing is wider, really wide. I think like 27 feet wide. And that vehicle will eventually take crews down to the moon as well. So for some reason it stopped. You know, I think it will in the long run, but I don't know which one's going to make it to the moon first, Starship or Blue Moon by Blue Origin. You know, they do have a backup system, which is a smart thing to do by NASA. originally a few years back when they gave the contract out, they just gave it to SpaceX and said, okay, we'll have your Starship land on the moon, and that's going to be it. They're going to bring the crews up and down. And I was hoping that they were going to, you know, give it to another contractor as well. Oh, there isn't enough money, you know. But then, sure enough, a year or two later, they did put another contract out, and of course, Blue Origin wound up getting that. They had competition with another company. Blue Origin won that. I'm glad to see that anyway. Let me drop it. Okay. I always try to follow all these different launches. Right now, we have 7 people on board the International Space Station. And there's another crew going to be going up this Thursday, March 31st. And from Russia, well, from Kazakhstan, it's a Russian vehicle, the Soyuz vehicle. It's called Soyuz 25. It's going to be launched with a crew of 3, the space station. And you have one Russian. He's going to be the commander, Oleg Novansky, and then you have a woman going up from Belarus, of all places, the first Belarus astronaut. She'll be going up with an American astronaut, Tracy Dyson. Tracy's been up there 2 times before, one time on a show and one other time on a Soyuz rocket. Now she's going back up on another Soyuz rocket to the space station. So, temporarily, you'll have 10 people on board, and then eventually 3 of those people are going to be coming back. Actually, they have a special deal with this. The 2 that are going up with Tracy will actually be coming back, and they're going to be bringing somebody else back with them. So Tracy's going to stay. She'll be up there for 6 months, and eventually she'll come back on another Soyuz spacecraft, completely different one. And, you know, it's like musical chairs. Any comments? WS
comments. Yeah, I got one. It's out of left field. It was a satellite launched in 1977. Where in space is it now?
You're saying in 1957, the one by the Russians? That's Sputnik is, you know, I understand it's still in orbit. I think it went in slightly elliptical orbit. It went like 500 miles by 250 miles or something. So from what I understand, it's still in orbit. Along with the second stage, that stayed in orbit too. But yeah, of course they stopped functioning after a couple of weeks. They only ran out of batteries back to each other.
No, this one launched by the U.S. back in the 70s, I think, or the 80s. And I can't remember where it is today.
Oh, the first one that we sent up was Laura. That would have been right after Sputnik, and after that, a couple months later. That was a successful launch. And they had a couple of scientific probes on that. Functioned well. Again, that was battery operated, for me, I understand. And actually, they failed. But yeah, good old days. Back to you, Charlie.
Battery's dead and it's no longer transmitting information.
Yeah, they were only designed probably in, I don't know how long Explorer 1 was, you know, how long that lasted. Eventually batteries quit. Wasn't until years later that they started sending up solar panels, the planetary ones with the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, where still operating today. But, yeah. And time marches on, thousands and thousands of satellites. If you've ever seen the picture, you look at the map that NORAD looks at. It looks like you can't even see the Earth. Thousands of things going around the Earth. They said around 100,000 items flying around the Earth, and only like 10,000 of them are really operable. Back to you, John.
Is there any way of bringing the inoperable back?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them have actually come back down, especially if it's in a low Earth orbit. They'll start to degrade the rarefied air. The molecules are hitting it, but enough to slow it down. Next thing you know, if you go into a low Earth orbit, you could have a vehicle come back in a couple of months. But once you get into the higher orbits, it takes decades, if not long, maybe depending on how high it is before it ever comes back. Look at the geosynchronous satellites that are up there. They're never coming back. They're 23,000 miles above the Earth. They're traveling at 17,500 miles an hour around the Earth. And they're never coming back. When they fail, they push them into what they call the graveyard orbit. They'll have a little fuel left on board, and they don't push closer to Earth. They push further away from Earth. And that's the graveyard orbit. That's where those things go. Depending on where it is, that's going to determine whether or not it's coming back or not. Someday in the future, where space flight is so cheap, some company will go out there and capture some of these satellites and bring them back. That way out there, put them in a museum, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, but what's the possibility of running into one of those satellites and causing damage?
Very low, but it's not zero. You had an Iridium satellite and a Russian satellite hit one time. I would say 10, 15 years ago, whatever it was. And they intersected, and they just blew apart. And they're still in orbit today. But it's like a long line of junk. It's not like it blows out like if you were to shoot a bullet into a watermelon, everything just blows out, in all different directions. It's like, as if the watermelon became spaghetti-fied, and it just became long, and that's what happens, because there's no air to make pieces go all over everywhere. But yeah, it's happened. But NORAD does a great job at a track of where all the debris is, all the active satellites and all the inactive satellites are, and they do a pretty good job. There was one, I think about a month ago, they came within, like a block of it, one another, a couple hundred feet, very close. It's possible. As time goes on, it's going to be, more, of course, more satellites you put up there, there's more of a chance of something happening. SpaceX has almost 6,000. Their goal is to put around 30,000 up there. So China wants to do the same thing. Blue Origin with their Kuiper mission, they want to put around 4,000 up there. No wonder we can see the stars, Charlie.
It's going to be crowded up there, and then we're going to start running into this satellite, that satellite. And then the engine's
going to
burn up a couple of more satellites.
Yeah, understood. I just put a program on my cell phone, an astronomy program. And no matter what, wherever you point it, you see, if you point it to the south or if you point to the north, you see a point to the north. And you look at the stars that are on the cell phone, and it'll tell you what every star is, where the planets are, and it's really neat. But, if you look at it real close, you can see little things moving here and there. So what are they? So you zoom in on it, But they are, they're satellites. Sometimes it's a Russian satellite, American satellite, or European or Chinese satellite. And it'll tell you which satellite you're looking at. But by far the most that keep floating by are Starlink satellites by SpaceX. It's really a good program.
Wow, that's interesting.
Okay, let me just move on here a little bit. The crew that came back just recently from space, from the International Space Station. It's a crew of four. They've been up there for 6 months. And they successfully landed in the Gulf of Mexico near Pensacola. They came down on a SpaceX Dragon crew vehicle that they had gone up on, and for all hands, every one of the people that came back. The commander of the flight was a woman, Esmond Morvelli. Sure enough, she's from Long Island. She comes out of Baldwin. She comes out of. She did a couple of contacts with students, not only ham contacts, but they do video and NASA sets things up like that. There's the piece on that on the news. And, well, anyway, she's back with Wolgenstein. He came out of the European Space Agency, and a fellow from Japan. He's back. He came back with them, and a Russian. All these flights now, we send up Crew Dragon, we usually put one Russian on. And when Russia sends up a Soyuz vehicle, we usually have one American on that one as well. And the idea is always to make sure you have at least one Russian and one American that knows how to fly either an American spacecraft or a Russian spacecraft, in case there was a problem. And the idea is always have at least one of each on board the space station. And that's the deal they made, before this thing ever went up. And as far as the first piece that ever went up was 1999. Any comments?
No comments, but I'm listening.
Understood. Very good. There's one story that's been in the news for a couple of months. Voyager 1 is, it's around, 160 AU, 160 times away from the Earth as the Earth is from the Sun. And, they've been contacting me here. This vehicle, along with Voyager 2, since 1977, when they both launched. And, the story is, are these things ever going to quit working? And Voyager 1 has been sending back science, information, all these decades. Until recently, a couple of months ago, the data that they were getting back didn't make sense. They would receive it. It would be like somebody just sending a bunch of zeros and ones randomly. They knew they were getting reception from Voyager, but apparently something quit. They're thinking maybe something on board the computer, which is from the 1970s, was not working. And they've been working on it. Can't find a problem. Turns out one of the workers from the Deep Space Network that's involved with receiving signals from dozens of these deep space vehicles, he looked at the data, and he was able to figure out what it was. Apparently something to do with the computer had not crashed, but started sending out information that didn't make sense to anybody who would be listening to it, except for this guy figured out what it meant. So now they hope they're able to transmit information back, and apparently what they're doing is able to figure out where the problem is, and they think they can correct it. As far as I know, it hasn't been corrected yet, but now at least there's hope to save Voyager 1. So we'll see how that works out. Voyager 2 is doing fine. Voyager 1 is the one that's furthest away. They're both outside of the, officially outside the reaches of the solar system. Officially in galactic space, they call it. We'll see. I got my fingers crossed. Jet Propulsion Laboratory is one that handles that. So, they're hoping to get a minimum of 50 years out of the vehicle. It was never planned to last that long, but it's working out. This WS-12.
Got a question.
Certainly. Back to you, Charlie.
Now, how long has Eli Musk been in the space business?
I read the book. Let me think. He really started thinking about this around 2000. His goal was to he wanted to launch a rocket and send it to Mars, land on Mars, and with a little seed in it, he was going to try to grow a flower inside the spacecraft. You know, that's the way the story went. I mean, that was his goal. So he went off to he went with another guy. The guy was a ham too. He used to be the NASA administrator at one time. I'm trying to think of his call. N3 something or other. Anyway, they went off to the Ukraine of all places, where Ukraine was making rockets for Russia. And his goal was to buy one of these rockets and bring it home and try to launch it, thinking he's going to send it to Mars. And, you know, he went there and he realized the complexity involved, and, you know, he was way over his head. But he still wanted to do what he was doing, so he decided to take all his money and pour it into the space program. So I would say beginning of the millennium, I would say he started to really get involved. Started to develop the Falcon, actually called the Falcon 1 rocket, and that's the first one that eventually made it to orbit. Launched from Kwajalein Island on the Pacific. So I would say at that time, he's probably thinking about this 25 years, I guess, back to each other.
Because I'm looking at his website, and he seems to have failures. He said his rocket goes up, but it crashes. He's had a few mishaps, huh?
Yeah, I know. I've talked about that a lot, you know, on this net. His way of thinking is, you know, put a rocket together the best you can and test the parts that you can best you can. But, you know, don't go overboard, you know, with all kinds of test equipment. Just put it together, launch it, and then see what goes wrong, and we'll do it again. And, you know, with another rocket. And, okay, this one was a little bit better, you know. And that's the way they think. He did that with the Falcon rocket. They said he had three failures, and he had enough money left. He was running out of money. Wanted to launch the fourth one, Falcon 1 rocket, and like I said, from Kwajalein Island out in the Pacific. And with luck, he launched this thing, and it didn't make it to orbit. You know, it didn't have a satellite or anything; just had a mass weight on it, you know, to duplicate a satellite. So, with that success, you know, NASA was looking for a private company to launch satellites and spacecraft to the space station. And with that, he wound up with $1 billion contracts from NASA. And, you know, he rolled the dice at once. He's doing the same. He did the same thing with the Falcon 9 driving. In the beginning, he was, you know, launch rockets, and you know, if they weren't successful, he'd just launch another one. Tried to land them on the drones. He must have crashed a half a dozen of these things on the drone when they came back, you know, to boost it. Finally, he got it right. Now he's doing it with Starship. Now we're up to Starship number 4. I would say that if NASA did that with their contractors, primarily Boeing and Lockheed, eventually Boeing and Lockheed got together, called it a United Launch Alliance, but if they did that with their private contractors, even before that with Rockwell, when they were building Apollo and everything, if so many of their rockets would be launching and explode, you know, they did, you know, in the beginning, but I mean, one right after the other, and if that was the rationale, we'd drop it.
I thought by now that they would, you know, have this thing get out because NASA's been making rockets for 50 years.
Yeah, but these are different. These things are coming down vertically, landing. They're not throwaways. So, you know, if the government had not, if NASA was blowing up rocket after rocket like Elon Musk did, the taxpayer would turn around and say, what are we paying for this? You know, we can't do this. But SpaceX is a private company. If he blows it up, he wants to build a new one, no problem. You know, that's the way they think. But NASA doesn't think like that. They have to go through so many tests and everything for every little piece, put it all together, and sure enough, when they launch it, works. They did that first rocket, first brand new rocket they had in a long time, which is called the Vulcan rocket. They launched a couple of months ago. Vulcan is going to replace the Atlas V and the Delta IV. And sure enough, that thing went up 100% successful. What a beautiful launch. Brand new engines, brand new design, brand new rocket, new tanks, new everything, and 100%. And now you're going to start to see Vulcan rockets going up one after the other. They're not reusable at this point, but they do have a plan on reusing their engines, which is the most expensive part of the vehicle. They do have a long-term plan for that. So, yeah. Anyway, back to you, Charlie.
What's the price of the engines?
Oh, I don't know. It's, you know, percentage-wise, it's probably, you know, 80% of the value of the whole vehicle. But cost of launching rockets, you know, for decades, it was like $300 million on a American F-5 or a Delta rocket. You know, they were paying, you know, anywhere from $250 million to $350 million. And not only NASA, but, you know, the National Reconnaissance Orbit Office, you know, government, you know, CIA type of satellites, you know, would be launched. So, you know, it's not all NASA money, but all our rockets that were going up were in a, you know, $300 million category. SpaceX comes along, and out of they have these things that are reusable. You know, their Falcon 9 is, they claim it's $62 million to launch it. Well, that was years ago, so, you know, figure $70, $80 million to launch a rocket. You know, probably one-third cost of what NASA and the government, the Defense Department was paying. So the numbers have really dropped. But, yeah. I would say the cost of the engines themselves, I don't know. Well, I'd just say they're 80% of the cost of any rocket. That's my guess. Back to you.
Yeah, but Starship, they're crashing these things. They're not off the ground. They're still in this stage. I can't see how you can go back to a private company and have trouble getting off the ground.
Comment.
Okay. Yeah, they've gone through over 100 Raptor engines so far, I'm sure, with all the rockets. Each one is, what, 33 engines, plus another 6 on the Starship itself. So, go ahead, comment.
Yeah, KC2, SHO here. Now, a lot written about things like success that comes through failure. Unfortunately, failure doesn't have a very good PR aspect. People see a failure, they laugh, oh, look at that, you know, he crashed another one. Don't underestimate what they're learning from failures. That can be more valuable than a lot of other things. And again, you know, in sectors that may not be acceptable, governments hate that as PR. Government agency have a little trouble in Congress or things like that, I don't know, but I hope the point's getting across. And there's a really good book about why success comes from failure. It's pretty interesting.
Nap time complete.
Don't underestimate it. KC2, SC2.
Oh, I agree, John. Oh, yeah, that every flight that goes up, he's doing it. You know, he's learning from it. And SpaceX, I heard them say that they don't consider any of their flights a failure at all. They just, you know, it's just a learning experience. Their next flight is, whatever goes up, it's just a flight that hasn't succeeded yet. Yeah, they don't even call them failures. So, yeah. But, you know, you can imagine a committee sitting around in Congress, you know, with if the space launch system was going to be blowing up every time they tried another one. Each one is like a $1 billion flight. I'm not kidding. On the space launch system, you know, they'd be sitting there talking to the head of NASA, you know, Bill Nelson. They'd be drilling him. You got these things blowing up all the time. What are we paying for? These contracts with SpaceX, they're not cost plus contracts. It's not time and material. The contract goes out, and he said $1 billion or $2 billion, whatever it is. If you're going to go over that number, you know, they have to eat it, and that's what they've been doing. And the same thing with Boeing and Lockheed, United Launch Alliance, building the Vulcan rocket and the Starliner that they're building. They're going to put on top of the Atlas V next month, in May, launched to the International Space Station. That thing is way over budget, you know. They have a $2 billion contract. They're probably over twice that amount, and Boeing's paying for the whole thing. So that's the proper way to do it. I think. Anyway, back to you, John.
You're real good. Yeah, I think you better, which most people can put it more eloquently than I can. Exactly, and yeah, they're getting paid for a deliverable, and that may be a faster and, surprisingly to some people, more cost-effective method to getting to that deliverable. Good. I'm chopping some veggies and things here in the kitchen, so I'll be listening though. I'll try to comment when I'm killing the spaceship back to you, Keisho.
Very good. Thanks for that, John. Thank you. I was getting late. I don't know. I just wanted to talk about this Strato launch. Strato launch is a vehicle that runs on. It's a jet plane, the carrier plane. The idea is to be able to carry, let's say, a rocket or a spacecraft to a height of 45,000 feet and let it drop and have it take off. Strato launch. It's got a 6 jet engines on it. Each engine is similar engine to what you would put on a 747. So it's like running a 747 with 6 engines. It's got 2 fuselage and then, you know, wing in between it, and then so it's a carrier vehicle. Paul Allen, from, you know, he used to be involved with Microsoft, one of the developers of that, poured his money into this project. Unfortunately, he died a few years back. The Strato launcher, you know, kept being developed. It was originally designed to carry spacecraft to be launched to orbit. you know, those days are gone. In fact, they were going to get involved with SpaceX at one point. They're still using it, though. Now they're using it as hypersonic vehicles. They launched something called the Talon A vehicle. And last week they carried it up, dropped it at 45,000 feet, and this thing took off. And they're not giving the report of how fast it went, but they're thinking it got, you know, close to Mach 5 or above Mach 5. This is a hypersonic vehicle. Mach 5 is the speed you have to go for that. Now they're working on another one that they plan on launching, Talon 2. This one has landing gear and everything on it, so they're going to test it. I don't know if they're going to send it at the hypersonic speed in the beginning or not, but they're going to see if it launches and how it lands on a runway. It's all being done out in Edwards Air Force Base out in California.
Paul?
Yes, go ahead.
They did that back, in the 90s they were piggybacking a rocket to a Boeing 747, and they were taking it off. That's not new technology.
Yeah, you're right. And there were 42 Pegasus launches. Originally, they started with the B-52, and then they switched over to 7-7, Lockheed L-1011 was Lockheed's version of 747. And however many they built, there's only one left. When NASA was doing this, there was only one left. NASA had it, and they were using it to drop the Pegasus rocket that would, you know, send their payloads into space. And they did quite well with it. They went to different places. They went out to Spain with it. So yeah, it's been done before. But the difference is this carrier that's going up is the biggest airplane that's ever been built. So the weight that it can carry is going to be a lot more than what a 747 can carry, for instance. The 747 that Virgin Galactic had, it eventually changed. They took their name and had an offshoot of that company, and they called it Virgin Orbital. Virgin Orbital took a 747, one of their old planes, one of Virgin's planes, and they converted that so they could drop a rocket from that. And they tried three or four times. It was unsuccessful. And then one time they did make it to orbit. And they tried another flight recently in England, and it didn't work out. And that company is now, they defaulted on that company. That's finished. And they sold off all their equipment, the building that they had. In fact, one building they had in Virginia, where Rocket Lab has a launch pad, and they took that. The Rocket Lab took it over. The Virgin Orbital is gone. But the idea of this one is this: they could carry not only heavy things, but they could carry multiple things up into space, up to 45,000 feet. So it's called a Strato launcher. It's really something. Put that into your computer, watch a YouTube on this thing taking off. It's an amazing equipment. Another thing that has a carrier type vehicle dropping is Virgin Galactic. They have the jet engine, they have a fuselage on one side, another one on the other, and they have the same type of design, but of course it's nowhere near as powerful as the Strato launcher. But they take the passenger vehicle, they call it Spaceship One, and they attach it to that, and they drop that, send a crew of six up to suborbital space. You know, that's still going on. That one's called a white knight. So, yeah, you're right, Charlie. It's not new, but it's just, you know, the idea is this thing is just bigger. That's why it impresses me. Back to you, Charlie.
Biggest space shuttle. I mean, and the idea is good because it's reusable.
Yeah, it's just carrier. It comes back and lands. But how big is the space shuttle? That thing was as big as a regular jet plane. 707, I guess. That was a massive piece of equipment that used to fly. Yeah, but no, they wouldn't. I don't think they never had those kind of plans for the 747. But they did used to take the 747. They used to take the shuttle and put it on top of the 747, and they used to fly it all the way back. But it wasn't. I think if they had fuel in it, I don't know if the 747 would have made it up the ground, Charlie. Remember that when they used to fly it from, let's say it landed in California, and they needed to bring the space shuttle back to Florida. They would put it on top of the 747, and that's how they did it. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, but can they scale the space shuttle down a little bit?
Well, they got Dream Chaser. That's 25% the size of a shuttle, and that'll be flying hopefully this April. Another month from now, I'll be flying on a Vulcan rocket out of Launch Complex 41 in Florida, and that'll be the first flight of Dream Chaser, and that's a cargo vehicle that will dock to the space station, and eventually they unload cargo. It would stay there for maybe weeks or months at a time, and then they would fly it. They plan on flying it back and landing on the in the beginning. Landed on the runway in Florida, the old shuttle runway. But that's 25% the size of it. And they have a crew vehicle they're working on. The first one that they developed is the cargo vehicle, Charlie. And after this, I'm going to have to look to close this portion of the net. Back to you, Charlie, for any last comments.
I think they should scale down the space shuttle because this thing is reusable. Let's get that base plane to get it off the ground.
Increase
the power tremendously. So, that's my idea.
And
I'll speak to you next week, Paul.
Real good, Charlie. Similar to it. They take the Dream Chaser, they're putting it inside of a fair on top of a rocket, in the case of the Vulcan rocket. Vulcan rocket gets it to space, and then this thing's got wings and everything. It's eventually going to fly back like the space shuttle. And the same idea, but it's just that space shuttle is very expensive. they only launched 135 of those things. They can't afford to. Every flight that went up was minimum of about $500 million. That's big money. Anyway, we're going to close the portion of that net. We're going to turn this back to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night on the Club InfoNet, followed by Swap and Shop, and that's always followed by New Line. So, Line Market's the place to be on Monday night. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report for the Tech Man.
Thank you very much, Paul. As always, thank you for the SpaceNet Report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate all the people that participated tonight. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a few things. I hope we entertained you. I hope the malfunctioning didn't disrupt too many people's existence. Anyway, our rebels now are done. As always, I'd like to remind you what Dick would end his technical net with the recommendation to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. So please be kind to your friends, be kind to your neighbors. Try to be kind even to your enemies. What the hell? Anyway, and of course, good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try to keep your mind open. So everyone, have a great week. Be well, stay safe, and do, if you can, come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. And I will close this particular episode with the same closing comments that I've been making for the last year or so. I'm clear. Slava, Ukraine.
See you next week.
AC2VS or WS2N. Wonder if I do. You guys are still around. WB2BS.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2L repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2L repeater. W2.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2L repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Thank you.
repeater. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.